Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
And legendary composer and Grammy Award winning musician or composer, Bill Whelan. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Oliver. Nice to be here.
I don't know if you caught that story about Brian Gaynor. That you might remember. Do you know the Brian Gaynor?
I know exactly who he is.
Really?
It's amazing, actually, because I was just walking in the hallway with Janice and I heard Brian Gaynor's name. I heard you talking. I heard you mentioning Brian Gaynor. So I was in school with Brian Gaynor. What's he doing on the radio?
There's a message from New Zealand and someone saying that he might remember the night you were travelling from Kilkee and the car missed a sharp corner.
Yes, it did. And I actually exited the car. It was an Austin 1100, which was owned by, which his mother had
detail.
Just got a present of for her birthday. And she gave him the car for the day for us to go down to Kilkee.
Yeah.
And we went to Kilkee and we threw the guitars into the car and went off to Kilkee. And we sang for the day in Kilkee. And I was sitting on the way home in the back of the Austin 1100 and coming up to Nancy O'Dea's pub. Coming up to that, and we took a bend at a rather fair clip, and we exited the motorway, and we ended up.
Oh my God.
I the last thing I remember was the ditch coming towards me at some speed.
Oh no.
And I was in the back of the car with the guitar. I was playing the guitar at the time, and I came out the back window of the Austin 1100.
Are you serious?
I ended up in the ditch with the guitar. And this is true. I don't know how the two of us, me and the guitar, fitted out the back window. But I ended up in the ditch, and the car, which had been driven by Brian, his mother's new car, ended up in the middle of the road. And these guys came, drove up in another car. Lads, are you all right? Are you all right? We said, not quite. And they said, come on, listen. Nancy says, Fanny O'Dea's is closing. She's closing soon. Come on, we better go down. We want to get a pint before she closes. So they threw us into their car and we pushed the poor Brian's mother's car into the ditch and left it there. And that was the end of that car, actually. But luckily, it wasn't the end of us. There were three of us. Yes. That's Brian Gaynor. And then he went to New Zealand, not because of this. He went to New Zealand subsequently.
Your recall is unbelievable.
And he became very successful. And it's nice to hear that he texted in, did he?
It's a message from an Oliver Lee living in Galway. He must know.
Yeah.
He knew that you were friends anyway.
Oh, yeah.
You never know where these conversations go when you get messages from around the world.
The magic of radio. Yeah.
And when in the Middle Ages was that?
It was after the Rising.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it was a memorable, I can tell you. I did some damage to my eye.
I just remember being a very nervous
passenger for quite a while afterwards.
I'd say.
But anyway, we survived. But unfortunately, Mrs. Gaynor's car did not. And Mr. Gaynor had to drive out from Limerick to Fanny O'Dea's pub to bring us home. And it was the most silent car journey I've ever been in.
Yeah. I'm looking at your lovely autobiography, your memoirs, is the best way to put it, The Road to Riverdance. And there's a gorgeous picture of you and your dad sitting on a motorbike.
Yeah.
He was an older dad.
He was an older dad, yes. He was 50 when I was born.
Was he?
Yeah, he came late to the fatherhood. But they actually had one child before me, and he unfortunately died. And then I arrived.
You were an only child. That would have been unusual in Limerick, I'd imagine, with big families and young
parents.
Yeah,
exactly. My cousins and everything, there were loads of them. Sort of families of six and eight and stuff, but I was alone. But actually, it had its ups. Like my father being a bit older than all the other dads, he had more adult tastes. So I ended up hearing an awful lot of music. I mean, he brought every kind of music into the house. Mm. Everything from jazz, Thelonious Monk, right through to Glenn Miller, through then trad music, through opera, everything. So
cool dad.
From an early... Yeah, he was a very cool dad. Yeah, yeah. Bill, I mean, he brought... When you think of it, like, he would have been in his 60s when he brought sort of Bill Haley into the house, you know, wow. and Presley. And yeah. so, yeah, and he wired the house up so that he was very handy. He was a great man with a screwdriver. He wired the house up, and we with music like all over the house. So there would be little speakers which were linked up to the main radio.
It sounds like you had a lovely childhood.
It was very nice. I loved it growing up in Limerick, I have to say. You know, we grew up in the street next to the McCourts.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they were. Well, they had gone. Frank and Malachy, God rest both of them now. I got to know them later in later years, and they'd gone to America. But I remember their house. You know, that was the McCourts' house. And Limerick was, you know, it was pretty accurately recorded, I think, by Frank. He had a tough childhood.
Oh yeah.
But that life in Limerick in the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s was tough enough, you know, for certain families.
Narrows and laneways and like the
patrol. That's right. The lanes were right behind our house, so they're not there anymore. They've been knocked, and they're sort of sheltered living for old folk there now, you know.
But the place was heaving with talent.
It was, and there were all these bands, you know. I mean, not alone was I hearing music in the house, but then there was a lot of music in the city. And, you know, there were opera companies, and then there was the Sicilian Music Society. Unfortunately, the Limerick Music School didn't start until the 60s.
Right.
And I went to Limerick Music School. But up to then, my music education was really just just private tuition, you know.
Loads of traditional music?
Not lots of traditional music. You know,
is that right? Yeah.
It was city. Yeah. You know, the trad was being played in the country.
I see.
You yeah. know, you and Limerick, you didn't really, unless you sought it out, you didn't really get to hear it, you know. And it was...
Which is why you had a guitar rather than...
Well, exactly. And like, of course, our ears in the 60s, growing up in the 60s, your ears were immediately tuned to Radio Luxembourg and... You know, you were hearing. It was interesting, actually. One thing I was talking about recently was about how formatted radio came along later than that. But in those days, you heard everything. Like, if you put on RTE, in the same program, you could hear Frank Zappa and Frank Sinatra. You know, it was very interesting.
Yeah.
So the exposure to a whole wide range of music was actually more commonplace. Whereas now, we tend to, like, put our music into categories, and we like to have our audiences neatly lined up in groups that we can sell advertising to.
We also look at that era that you're describing very differently to how you're describing it. We see it as quite twee, don't we?
Yeah.
But there were cool things happening left, right.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there were lots of really, really great bands. And then, of course, I went to college, and of course, coming to Dublin for me was it was kind of really cataclysmic, really, because I had, you know, a fairly sheltered life, you know, as an only kid growing up in Limerick. And then I came to Dublin right in the middle of the student revolution in the late 60s.
Yeah.
So there was all these...
You weren't attracted to that?
Well, I was certainly attracted to it, but I didn't really understand it. I was 18, you know, and here we were, and we were occupying buildings, and, you know, there were baton charges by guards and stuff that I don't, you know, never saw in Limerick, really.
It was a nice quiet time down there.
Yes, exactly.
Listening to jazz.
Yeah.
Ructions in Dublin.
Yeah, it was an exciting time, and it kind of challenged your worldview, you know. It was like all the old certainties were being pulled out and aired, and that was... You know, and programs like The Late Late Show, funnily enough, it's kind of, we're talking about it today quite a bit, what the plans are for RTE.
That's right, yeah.
You know, The Late Late Show was a very, very important piece of broadcasting in terms of it presenting an emerging Irish society with an image of itself.
It was a challenge,
was changing,
wasn't it?
Changing, yeah, exactly.
Where did your career then in music go? Because I gather you said your dad was handy. Did he build a recording studio?
Yeah, he did.
In the house?
Yeah, I mean, a recording studio now might be a grand word, but we had egg boxes and era board. And, and actually, he did build a control room. And we had a glass with, you know, like here.
No, it
wasn't as fancy as this here.
Probably better than you.
And we had a Vortexian tape recorder and recorded all kinds of things. And I was writing songs at the time. In fact, I'm doing one of those songs in the concert with the symphony orchestra.
One of the songs you wrote?
One of the ones from that time.
Go away.
Yeah, because I sort of saw myself as a... I had ambitions to be a songwriter, but then I got very much interested in arranging and producing. And actually, you know, RTE, again, kind of come back to that for a minute. Mm-hmm. Like when I eventually did a law degree, and yeah. When I qualified with my degree, I went straight into music, which is an obvious move, of course.
You're supposed to become a lawyer, isn't that the plan?
Yeah, exactly. That was not quite what my parents had imagined. But anyway, I did. And I ended up doing a lot of work here in RTE, not as an employee, but as a contracted musician.
Okay.
And it was very, very interesting in those days where it was interesting walking through the radio centre today. In those days, there was a whole community. It was like a campus, actually.
Yeah.
And in many ways, for me, I learned a lot of my orchestration skills, any of my musical skills, simply through the community that all worked in the one place in RTE at the time.
And as a young guy, you wanted to come here. That
exactly,
was the place to go.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah. You were sought out. And, yeah, you did work. And if it was good, then you got another job out of it. And it was an exciting time. And, you know, the fact that we were making a lot of... RTE was making a lot of home-produced music programs in those days. So there was, like, small bands that would need arrangements. And then there were, of course, the orchestras were making... the RTE concert orchestra were making programs. They were often, like, week-long series or 8-week-long series.
Of course, there are more opportunities outside now, aren't there? I mean, there were a few places you could go at the time.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, the whole vista has changed, hasn't it? In that, you know, in many ways through the internet and everything.
Bedroom studios.
Well, that's the thing, is that we've created something which is perhaps the greatest method of human communication. Mm. But actually, funnily enough and ironically, the effect of that is that we've turned into more solitary beings in some ways.
You're dead right, yeah.
You know, we used to, you know, I did an album recently with Colin McInamara and we all sat in the studio and played together. It was kind of, wow, this is very refreshing.
Humans.
Humans. Yes, playing humans playing together. And like, obviously the orchestra does that all the time. But I mean, you know, songwriters and people who produce music now are working out of these small silos at home, you know, and everybody has a home studio of some sort.
I want to go back a little bit because your parents, they ran the shop, mum and dad, and someone messaged earlier on about they remembered the shop.
Yeah.
So that was the life. Coming from there, getting a law degree, when do you start having a career in music? When does it start making a living for you?
I hope to.
It was just a hope still. You only hope to now.
Yes, yeah. Actually, it's, you know, the one thing about the music business is that there really is no path, is there? It's like you just, I remember kind of hanging around musicians.
Which is important as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it was.
You're probably urgently wanting to go out and
you're standing there.
The hanging around was part of the process.
Yeah, you're standing there hoping that somebody's going to give you spot you and bring you in. But yeah, I mean, I went to a... I was writing these songs and making these recordings at home and elsewhere. And eventually I got a deal from Polygram Records to record some of my songs, which I did. And that brought me into contact with a lot of professional musicians in Dublin. I ended up in the studio with people like Louis Stewart, Des Moore, Desi Reynolds, John Drummond, all these musicians who were working on the scene. And that brought me into a scene. And I remember Desi Reynolds came to me one day and he said, would you fancy playing piano in Jesus Christ Superstar? Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And I did the audition and I got it. So that got me on the road of working with other musicians.
Did you contact Richard Harris at some point?
Oh, that was way back.
Okay, that was earlier.
The time of Brian Gaynor's car. Yeah, I had written a piece of music and recorded it in Limerick.
Right.
And a friend of mine brought it into Richard Harris's office in London. And at that time, he was making a film called Bloomfield. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Webb was supposed to write the score. But Jimmy Webb's career had gone right through the roof and he was busy all the time, and Harris was looking for a theme music for the thing. And anyway, my friend brought this music in, these songs and instrumental pieces, And they said, yeah, just leave them on the desk there and we'll have a listen to them. After 2 days, my friend, who I call Mike O'Mahony, rang back and he said, do you listen to those tapes? And they said, well, actually, we're really busy at the moment. And he said, well, don't worry. He said, I'm going to come around and pick them up. He said, because we've just got a big offer from RCA. And by the time he got around to the Harris's office, they'd listened to the tapes.
Oh, right.
And Richard Harris said, I want that music for my score for my film, Bloomfield. So suddenly I went from Limerick, a hopeful songwriter, to a guy who'd written the theme music for a Richard Harris film. And I was brought to London and I'd never been in a plane before.
Great experience.
Yeah, amazing. In studio, remember Shirley Bassey was in the studio and Harris. And I mean, it was just an incredible time. But
he's
then
a megastar at the time. But
I thought everything was, this was it. Like it was one quick move from school to megastar.
Don't have to hang around at all. No, exactly. Straight to stardom.
So it wasn't to be the film didn't really happen.
Okay.
And I ended up having to go back to studying. And but it still was a great experience.
You got a flavour of what was to come.
Well, I ended up going to parties with people like Christine Keeler and
Yeah.
I mean, it was
Perfume Affair.
Yeah, exactly. People who brought down governments, you know.
Yeah.
And I was just 18, you know.
Again, the hanging around.
The hanging around worked. But, yeah.
Bring us to the place then, because I want to play one of the early pieces, which is like a precursor to Riverdance in many ways, isn't it?
Time Dance. Yeah.
And that's with Planxty. And that relationship was really important in your life, wasn't it?
Very, very important to me, it was. And Donal Lunny and Andy Irvin and Liam, excuse me, and Christy, they were all very important in my life. But Donal and Andy particularly, because they were interested in what I was doing keyboard-wise. and they brought me into the band. And I toured with Planxty for a while. And then the Eurovision was happening here, and Ian McGarry, who was director, God rest him, at the time, he rang me and said, you know, would you do the music for the centrepiece of Eurovision, which is exactly the Riverdance spot that was to happen 13 years later.
Yeah.
And so I said, yeah. And I said, look, what about I do it with Planxty? And he said, wow, that'll be amazing. But do you think they'd do it? And so we talked about it in the band. And we agreed it, and Donal and I sat down to write it. So Liam, he presented the first piece, which was the traditional air, and then I wrote a piece called Isser Claren, and then Donal wrote the Ballymun Regatta, and I orchestrated it, and we recorded it, and we got a record deal from Warner's for it.
So it was a big deal at the time.
It was a big deal at the time.
Here's a little taste of it for people just to remember. And we can kind of hear almost, it's like the pilot for Riverdance in some
kind
ways.
Kind of, yeah.
Time Dance.
Yeah.
You could almost sense like the reaction to it, the lovely finale.
Yeah, it was a great piece to do, and we still do it, you know, and we'll be doing it with the Symphony Orchestra at the concert and the NCH.
5th of July celebration.
Yeah, I'm sorry, my watch keeps reminding me of something. I don't know what it is.
It's got a nice chime at least. That's what you'd expect from a composer.
Anyway, it was a great thing at the time, and it was a very successful record for Planxty.
Hmm.
And it sort of, you know, when I came to do Riverdance those many years later, I called Riverdance because I wanted to make the connection to Time Dance.
Way.
Yeah.
So that's all.
Because one wouldn't have happened without the other. Now, we didn't have Irish dancing in Time Dance. We had ballet. It was done by the Dublin City Ballet.
Right.
But
the elements are there.
Yeah,
the structure of what you're planning to do.
Exactly, yeah.
Are you sick of talking about Riverdance?
Well, you know, I have to say, if Riverdance was something that just happened and then we just talked about it in the past, it's still very present.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's playing in the Gaiety at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's an entire company I've hastened to say that are dancing and playing in the Gaiety this evening, and they are all none of them were born when I was writing it. So that says something. It says something that, like, for the last 25 years, and pretty soon we'll be celebrating the 30th anniversary, it's still going. And we've just come back from China. And, you know, the show is, it just seems to be evergreen. And what's happened is that, you know, when Riverdance was done originally in 1994, 95, you know, there wasn't any such thing as a professional Irish dancer. But now there are lots of professional Irish dancers, and there are professional Irish dance schools. And also there's a whole body of musicians that, you know, when I did Riverdance initially, I had the cream of Irish trad musicians, Davy Spillane, Martin O'Connor, you know, all those guys. But nowadays, there are all these young players and they're phenomenal. I mean, we have a group of musicians in the Gaiety who are just fantastic. And the standard, you know, has just grown and grown. And more particularly, what's been interesting is that the musicians nowadays are very, very careful of the tradition. They play it.
Yeah.
They understand it and they link to it. But they're also curious. And, you know, I was talking recently about Andy Irvine. Like, Andy Irvine is over 80 years of age now. And, you know, he is still violently curious about
very
music.
Violently curious.
Oh,
I like that phrase.
He'll never stop. I mean, he's just always on the watch and listening. And I think that's such a healthy thing for a musician.
The original interval act, Riverdance, it was 7+ minutes long?
Yeah.
That's 30 years old now, because obviously you've got the 30th anniversary. You then had to sit down and write an entire show.
Yeah, exactly.
How long did you have between? Because it seemed like just a year later it was on the road.
It was less than a year. The instinct was, my daughter always had the instinct that we should put it on before the Eurovision came around again.
Oh, go away. Got the pressure.
We did. And I think I wrote the first piece for the show. We did a lot of research. Moya and I toured around a bit and went to Eastern Europe, went to Spain. We listened to music. I went to Atlanta. We listened to music from everywhere. Mm. And then I sat down to write it. And I don't think I wrote the first piece until October, and we were open. You know, we were actually in rehearsal after Christmas. It was incredible.
Are you serious? That's incredible. This is a piece, Reel Around the Sun, which is gorgeous. What's happening in the show?
This is the very beginning of the show.
The very beginning.
Yeah.
Come out on your chest. That one there. There's loads of lovely messages coming in. You mentioned Andy Irvine. You've worked with Planxty. You too. You produced something
on the War album. Yeah, yeah.
Because your association with Eurovision is very deep, because you also arranged some of Johnny Logan's.
I did the orchestrations for What's Another Year and for Hold Me Now, and the association with Shay Healy and with Johnny was through several Eurovisions, actually.
Wow.
So
is there anyone currently around that you listen to and you go, I'd love to work with that person there now?
It's a good question. I heard somebody called Willow the other day. It was a black musician.
Yeah.
I think she's the daughter of Will Smith.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, and I just think she's very interesting. I mean, that'll
be quite a collaboration.
There's so much great music happening. I'm not sure that all of it's, you know, the big thing with the internet and with streaming and everything is to try and find a place a way to get your music. You, obviously, somebody like Taylor Swift has no problem, but it's the person who's doing something special in their little studio to get that out.
Because the record companies are still really in charge, despite all the avenues we have.
Well, they are, and they're not. I mean, the record companies are you know, they're essentially conservative. You know, they're looking for the next thing that's like the last thing.
Would you, Riverdance, I presume, is life-changing for you as it was for
totally,
a few others.
Yeah.
Do you think you could have made it now if you were just starting out?
I would have. Well, you see, if I were starting out, I would have been probably more exposed to, you know, you have a time. And I was at a time, you know, if I look back through my own musical life, I came through what was a revolution of the whole Beatles. And what happened to songwriting. You know, I did a piece recently, a talk about the popular song and how the popular song had moved from Tin Pan Alley, you know, the beginning, the end of the 19th century into the 20th century, on in through, you know, the various moments in songwriting, and then the Beatles, and then the whole folk revival, where you had people like Woody Guthrie. I have to tell you, I came across a song in part of that research. I came across a song by Woody Guthrie, which is called "Old Man Trump." He wrote it in 1954, and it's about
easy to find.
It is about Donald Trump's father, and absolutely,
really,
Old Man Trump. And how he sowed the seeds of racial hatred with his housing projects in America. I mean, so songwriting moved into
the source of that empire.
Yeah, exactly. And but songwriting moved into in those mid 50s, 60s with Guthrie and you know, all of the with Dylan, obviously, moved into the sort of more political, social commentary and things. Then Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon. And then on into
Ireland,
rap, you know, it's been an incredible journey, and the popular song is still there in some form.
Might be saying less, the bigger ones, perhaps. But some of them have things to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fontaine's DC, particularly fond of the moment, and they have messages in their songs. Hold those thoughts for the moment, Bill Whelan, stay with us. We're going to come to people's messages, but we have to take a quick break. Now, loads of people are messaging in about various hits down the years, Bill, like the famous Guinness commercial you scored, probably the most memorable television in Irish culture. Everyone remember the white horses coming through the sea with the music that makes it special.
The Guinness Wave, yeah.
Will they feature in the
Guinness Wave, no.
Because that's
be
a
doing
jazzy.
Any advertising for alcohol advertising. But we will be doing Time Dance. We will be doing, obviously, River Dance. And also, I've had a joy of working with two great young trad musicians, Seamus and Cuiva O'Flaherty. And we've done a number of projects together, starting with Seamus and now with Seamus and Cuiva. But I wrote a piece. You know, I've been involved in projects to do with music education.
You have,
Music Generation being one of them.
Still going strong.
Still going strong. And also with the Contempo String Quartet. So I wrote a piece for the Contempo String Quartet and for Seamus and Cuiva last year. And now we're doing a premiere performance of it at the concert on the 5th of July at the NCH with the National Symphony, a brand new arrangement, full orchestral arrangement of the piece with Seamus and Cuiva. And I have Tara Howley on pipes. She'll be coming in. And Athena Turgis. But we're doing Inis Lachen, which is a piece that I wrote. It was actually the first thing I wrote after Riverdance.
Okay,
it was a suite of a three-piece suite for two violins and chamber orchestra, and we're doing that with the symphony orchestra. So it's
a
whole
busy
range
show.
Of music. Yeah, there's a whole
so
range
celebrating
of music.
The stuff you've done and also new stuff.
New stuff, yeah, with great young fiddle player Julianne Forrest. She's coming in. You know, so we have a lot of new players, but housed within the symphony orchestra.
I love your enthusiasm for the young ones coming through and name-checking and making sure you...
Well, you know, it's again going back to our earlier conversation. You know, I think it's very much it's important for us, both the older ones, but for our society as a whole, to bring the youth forward, because that's our future, and they're going to find new ways of expressing the music and the literature or whatever. You know, so they have to be supported.
There's so many messages, we won't have time to come to them all, but there's lovely ones. Someone says, please say hi to Bill Whelan from Ian McGarry's Widow Jane. The importance of Time Dance, plus many other productions with Ian, to which Bill was critical, is often forefront in my mind. Thank him from me.
Yeah, well, can I just say about that? Ian McGarry was a great director in RTE, really fantastic. And in those days, in RTE, there was a whole community. I mean, I've referred earlier to the idea of a campus. It was like a big group of people all linking with each other. You came out here, you met all kinds of... There was a real sense of community, a real sense of... So guys like Ian McGarry would be rubbing shoulders. But he was also a musician, a fine musician, a drummer. And so there was all that sort of linking together of people that happened when there was a large campus here. It was like a university.
The campus is still here, but a busy campus filled with the future, basically, is what
exactly.
But Music Generation is maybe filling some of the void now.
Well, exactly. And Music Generation has done a fantastic job.
I've loved the chat with you. We have to take one more break just before we go. We're just out of time here with Bill Whelan. Thanks so much. The National Symphony Orchestra will celebrate your music. National Concert Hall. That's on the 5th of July with special... Loads of questions coming in. If you have 20 seconds, 20 someone's seconds. Wondering, why has Riverdance got a flamenco rhythm?
Because I was always attracted by, first of all, the link between the footwork of Irish music and Spanish music, but also the rhythms, the breakup of the rhythms. There are similarities, and you can find similarities when you break down the rhythms of Irish jigs and reels and you work with flamenco music. There are connections.
It's there and you found it.
It is.
Bill Whelan, thank you so much, and enjoy that celebration on the 5th of July.
Thank you very much.
Take
Oliver.
Care. Claire Byrne is next. We'll talk again. Slán.
0818 715 925. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.